is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
You know, when I look at the American economy, what I see is a healthy tortoise and not a sickly hare.
We should absolutely be shocked at that GDP number because one thing, 8 years of 0% interest rates, and this is what we get the first quarter of 2016?
Business has not been helped, it's been hurt. We have the worst tax system in the world. We have the worst regulatory burdens in the world.
The uncertainty created by this administration, which causes businesses not to want to grow. Corporate profits for the first quarter are going to be down 6%.
Barack Obama will be the only president in history who did not deliver 1 year of 3% growth.
The Federal Reserve has been giving false signals that the economy might turn around.
The guessing game becomes one of musical chairs in which we all wonder when this system, this artificial system, might implode.
The monetary policy, I think we've pushed that as far as we can.
It's really a confidence game.
Well, some big questions being raised about the stock market. It's been going up 10 weeks in a row. Can this trend continue? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Joining me on the program today in the first hour will be Jonathan Krinsky from MKM Partners. And he's taking a look at this and saying, we haven't done this too often that we've seen the stock market go up 11 weeks in a row. Well, we may be setting some records here. And he'll be talking about that and what it means if we continue to go up. Are there risks? You know, the old saying, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. Does that really apply when you have a run-up? You'll want to hear what he has to say about that, the best places to invest. And, of course, we will be talking to Frank Holmes about the gold market. The gold market has been holding up rather well and has been confirmed with silver, and we'll be talking about that in a special edition of the program coming up in hour two. I'll let John tell you about that. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And as Jim just said, I'm John Loeffler, and in hour two of the program for The Big Picture, we're going to feature an interview that we ran recently on the Premium Channel with Don Cox. That's the first part of The Big Picture. And then a special with Dave Morgan from Silver Investor on things that are going on in the silver market. That's the corpus of our Big Picture today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But as is our custom here on the program, we first talk to Ryan Poplava. And Ryan, feels like there's some fear out there that we've seen the rally since February, and it may be time to see a correction, which of course always breeds the jitters. There's the sell in May, go away adage. We're not quite to May yet, but we're almost there. You think some of that played into the end of the week and month weakness that we got? We saw it this week on Thursday, and it also spilled into Friday, especially given what we say, how much the market's gone up.
I'd say there were quite a few major events this week. You know, the FOMC meeting was one of them on Wednesday. Bank of Japan announced their policy decision on Thursday. And then we got a whole bunch of key economic figures that came out. So there was definitely a lot going on top of major moves in the earnings season this week. We had announcements from Apple and many other very large contributors to, you know, these are bellwethers that move the market. But, you know, I'd say interestingly, I don't think any of those affected the market as much as a single man did on Thursday. It's funny, in an interview he had on CNBC, Carl Icahn announced he's completely out of Apple stock. And that's a big deal because Apple stock, he had got into it, was largely, I think, influential in them doing a very large stock buyback program. I mean, that's speculation. And the main reason he gave that he got out of it completely recently, his concerns over China's economy and China being a big player in Apple's sales. So Apple has a very large weighting in the market and can influence the direction based on its performance. And interestingly, you know, there was a pretty big drop from its move off of earnings on Wednesday, and that did affect the market. But I think because of the FOMC meeting, that kind of balanced things out a little bit on Wednesday. But, you know, I don't think it was just his comments on Apple that moved the market. He made some really particular statements later in the interview about his current market position for his portfolio. And I think we should definitely bring that up for our listeners.
You know, it doesn't keep me from investing, and we have a lot of long positions, but then we have a huge short position on. And the short position obviously isn't working that well as the market goes up. But I have not changed my opinion that I do not believe that all these commodity stocks are not a bit too low. I think they overdid the commodity stocks. I think there you have a definite opportunity still, perhaps. But I do believe in general that that there will be a day of reckoning unless we get fiscal stimulus.
Yeah, so, you know, listen to that. The market was really even for the day. We were almost, I think we were only down like 2 points on the S&P at the time of that interview. But despite expectations being disappointed after the Bank of Japan's announcement, you know, we were just largely flat on the day. But after that interview, things rolled over and the market started a downtrend. We closed down, I think, 1%. I can't remember exactly on Thursday, but we definitely rolled over. And there was some concern from what I heard going even to Friday's morning that that was going to spill over. And it did. But it's funny because Buffett, you know, CNBC went right to Warren Buffett on Friday to get his comments on things, you know, maybe getting both of the gurus to weigh in on each other. But when asked about what one person thinks, he said, you know, 50,000 plus people traded in and out of the market on Friday. And he said he didn't give too much weighting to their decisions either on what they do and what they feel on the market is. So he doesn't really pay much too much attention to what one person says. And he said he himself doesn't know what the market's going to do one day from the next. So, you know, who can? But the market largely did move, I would say, based off of Carl Icahn's comments.
Okay, so we've put that one in the slot there. Beyond his comments, any other drivers you think were really key for listeners who may not have had a chance to hear about it in their very busy work week that could affect the big picture here?
You know, John, I continue to focus on a couple of things, as you know, I brought to the table many times, and that's mainly the U.S. dollar. You know, it's highly influenced by central bank policy decisions. We had two major ones this week. Comments from central bankers too, you know, the expectations of what the central bankers are going to do can move markets. And on top of that, economic results can move the currencies specifically. It was largely expected that the Bank of Japan was going to perhaps lower rates further in the negative territory. We've been hearing a lot from Kuroda and many others that we were expecting that the Bank of Japan was willing to do more, like the EC bid just not too long ago, and maybe also maybe purchase more in the side of equities. It didn't either. And so we saw a huge drop in the dollar-yen pair by almost 3% on Thursday, paired with the underwhelming first estimate for first quarter GDP. You know, we saw a pretty decent drop in the dollar this week. That's great for commodities. And that's, you know, largely since July of 2014, as we saw the dollar rise based on the ECB saying how much they were willing to do more of. And then we had the Fed pulling away from its accommodation, you know, ending QE, et cetera. It's been great for commodities recently that the dollar's been weakening. We've seen gold breaking out from a bottom. We've seen many commodity stocks. Oil itself has come back and people are talking about $50 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate. But, you know, it's also been great for multinational companies that are looking to export goods. It's been good for a manufacturing area that's been very weak over the past year. So these types of catalysts this week were actually, I think, long-term actually beneficial for the near-term. But, you know, who knows? I think, you know, the market's largely gone up here. The price multiple on the market's probably a little high, up near 18. So I think there's probably people are nervous. And so comments like what Carl had to say, how he's got a very large short and he thinks there's a day of reckoning if we don't have the fiscal stimulus, I think are all well and true, probably. But that definitely made people nervous based on how much we've gone up here recently.
Okay, what about earnings side of things this week? I know you mentioned we are in an earnings recession right now. I mean, everything's a little lackluster, ho-hummy. And we might possibly, they'll be at much lower market valuations had we not had this central bank gap narrow.
Yeah, that's a gap we've talked about since length. You know, this week, the economic results were mixed and earnings were somewhat mixed, but on the whole, you know, I think better than what was expected. And I think better than what we had heard from, you know, Microsoft and Google last week, which some concerns were raised. But, you know, I guess that said, according to Capital IQ, does a lot of research, first quarter earnings are on pace to decline by about 7.9%. And that continues to worry me, John. It seems most of the market got by recently on earnings and reactions weren't that severe because, you know, largely companies have beaten expectations and that's how these things get priced out. The bar was set low. God, I guess my one-year-old's ability to reach the counter just as low and she can barely get up there. But
well, you know, if you set the bar low enough, anybody can clear it. It's a matter of moving the goalposts, as I say. We can't make it that far. Well, let's bring it back in again. And that may or may not be an indicator of anything.
Yeah. And on the market, we call it sandbagging your earnings results.
Yeah.
Qualcomm's great at that. Many do it, though.
All right. So the earnings season is largely behind us. And we should still have, though, more announcements ahead next week. But really, the two critical weeks are past us right now. How are you guys positioned given the move up in the market and then the weakness that we saw this week?
Good question. I can't recommend any securities because of regulations, but I agree with Buffett. I don't think you can move based on what one person says about the market. You know, I always caution our listeners, you got to do your homework, obviously, and don't just listen to what I say. Do your homework. Look at the economic results. Make up your own decision. But looking at what has happened, we have had very large figures move the market. You know, it's just a short-term positioning type of thing, but based on what the market's done, our concerns about earnings, profitability from corporations, the financial stress indexes, which we talk about a lot, we've raised quite a bit of cash this week. I raised on Wednesday and, you know, gosh, we didn't even get to talk about the FOMC meeting on Wednesday. You know, they made no change, of course, but, you know, the comments I'm hearing from a lot analyzing the central bank decision was that the uncertainty we're starting to feel from them in their decision here about where things are economically. That's going to definitely affect investors, and uncertainty creates cautious investors. So we've raised cash. Like I said, I do have a hedge on. I bought it late this week on Thursday, but our large accounts have a good amount in short-term bonds since we began rotating there at the end of last year. And we didn't get to pick up on some high yields like we did back in January. I think we're waiting now for yields to kind of to come to us, but, you know, we'll see how things go there. You know, that's been in areas that have been largely weak, you know, energy, commodities related, and those have all come back very nicely and still look very good. Many of those junk bonds, the high yield bonds, were being priced at recession levels. So that was a great opportunity for us. We jumped on it for a lot of the income investors. Interestingly, John, I see some of the good things, like I said, fundamentally still happening. Jobs are still strong. Our leading economic indicators are still strong. So I'm not going to a bunker here. As I've mentioned many times in this show, I believe the market's in a trading environment. You know, I've heard people say, you don't buy the dips anymore, you sell the rallies. I think you do both. But, you know, the market's gotten a little bit pricey up here, a multiple, like I said, around 18. We've been a little cautious when that happens. We're not, you know, very defensive, not in our bunker, but at the same time, we're not as bullish as we were 6 months ago.
And of course, we will find out in the future as we go whether or not we are headed really downwards in a lot of different areas, although that seems to be the mood on the street right now. So we will see. Ryan Poplava, it's been an interesting week, I will say. I won't say it was an exciting week, but it was an interesting week. And we'll see you again next week when maybe it's a little more exciting.
And we'll see if any more iconic people can move the market.
Ah, ha, 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 ha. Where's my rim shot sound? Brum. All right. Well, I'll have to let something buffet that type of humor.
There you go. All right. I think we got to quit here.
Yeah. See you again next week, Ryan.
See you later.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Ben Hunt is the chief risk officer at Salient Partners and also the author of Epsilon Theory, where he regularly discusses the intersection of mass psychology, game theory, and the relationship to the dominant themes and forces driving the financial markets today. And Ben, in your most recent note, which was absolutely brilliant, by the way, called The Placebo Effect, you explain to us the mystery of the placebo effect and how it fits in today's markets. Would you mind describing what that note was about?
Sure, Chris, and delighted to be with you here today as well. So, you know, I was watching TV. I watch a lot of TV, and there was a commercial on for Botox as a treatment for chronic migraines, which is, you know, something that so many people in the country and around the world suffer with. And so it was wonderful to hear about this, you know, approved treatment that could really make a difference, because for chronic migraine sufferers, and that's defined as having 15 or more days per month with at least a four-hour headache, you know, just horrific, you know, a Botox treatment can be shown to eliminate up to 9 of those headache days, which is just a, you know, tremendous accomplishment. But something caught my ear and eye at the end of the advertisement, and it was, you know, essentially that compared to a placebo injection, you know, injection of just an inert saline solution or something like that, Botox was certainly effective, you know, eliminating up to 9 headache days, but a placebo injection eliminated up to 7 headache days per month, which, you know, I've always been fascinated with the power of placebo, or the power of, in this case, a doctor telling you a story, a narrative that you're being given a powerful medicine, when in truth the medicine has no effect on you, but that on certain physiological issues, just being told that story can have such an enormous impact on the way we experience migraine pain. And in many other things in medicine, anything that is essentially what they call brain regulated, this typically involves things like pain and not something like, oh, I have an unstable joint because, you know, my ACL is torn. A placebo effect won't do you any good there. But for things that are essentially brain regulated, a placebo, the story that a doctor can tell you is enormously effective, you know, almost as effective as a very powerful drug like Botox. So it got me thinking about our current markets and the way that investor behavior is certainly a brain-regulated issue, right? Particularly in these policy-driven markets where no one trusts this bull market. You know, and I've written about this a lot. I think we all feel it, right? The ground isn't steady beneath our feet. The traditional landmarks that we use for investing, the fundamentals that we would like to base our investment decisions on, they don't seem to matter very much. What does matter, we know, is policy. And so we're kind of unmoored. We don't trust the bull market. And so we're looking to avoid pain. We're looking to avoid a headache. And just as in medicine and the physiology of pain, essentially the behavior of market pain, if you will, is highly impacted by placebos.
Well, we started out rough. At the beginning of the year, most assets were going down, but since the lows of February, stocks are up, emerging markets are up, commodities have come back, and it's the risk-on trade. How long is this going to continue? Is there further to go, or is this just short-covering rally and liquidity created by perceptions of the Fed? Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky from MKM Partners. Jonathan, let's begin with something that you wrote about recently, that, you know, we've gone 10 consecutive weeks where we've had trading above the previous week. Let's talk about the implications for that, and how unusual is this, and can it persist?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So, and we're actually probably going to maybe even make it 11 weeks in a row without trading below the prior week's low. So the 10-week stretch is very unusual. Since 1982, which is as far back as we have this intraday data, we've only seen 7 streaks
that have gone on at least 10 weeks, and only twice has it gone 11 weeks. So amazing that today, even despite the news overnight in Japan, that we're still looking like that streak is intact. And basically what we found is that if you look out a week later, the market actually did finish positive 4 of those 7 times. But then when you look a month later, it actually finished lower 6 of 7 times. So it kind of depends on your time frame. You can kind of look at the data either way. But I think it is remarkable that since the February lows, we haven't even taken out the low of the prior week. And it's pretty rare to go actually 11 weeks.
Jonathan, what about the old cliche, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day? Given the fact that this market has been extended, as you pointed out, we may be heading for 11 consecutive weeks here. Does that make that cliche more, let's say, appropriate given the run-up that we've seen and the stretch valuations?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, look, seasonals are an average that tend to play out over time, right? So obviously, if it worked every year, then it would cancel out the effects. So, but clearly, over history, there has been a propensity for muted returns or the weakest part of the year to happen in this May to September-October timeframe. So given the fact that we've been up 14 or 15% off the lows heading into this period, it would certainly make sense to see some pause, see some consolidation here, given that, you know, we're extended on many metrics. But I think the bigger picture and what's interesting is when you look, we've actually now gone almost a year without making a new 52-week high. And that may not sound surprising. I think everyone knows it. But what's unusual is that it's very rare to go that long without making a 52-week high and not be in a bear market. And in fact, since in the last 50 years, we've only seen 11 occurrences where we've gone 11 months without a 52-week high, and 8 of the 11 times were in bear markets. Obviously, that makes sense when you're in a bear market. You're not making new 52-week highs. But there's just been 3 times when they happen outside of bear markets. So it was 1979, 1984, and 1995. So we're coming up on the one-year mark, and what we really find is interesting is when you actually finally make that new 52-week high for the first time in at least 11 months, the forward returns are staggeringly bullish. Looking out a month later, S&P was higher 10 of 11 times for an average 3% gain. And then looking at a year later, S&P was higher every single time for an average gain of 16%. So, you know, in theory, that makes sense because you've gone sideways for so long that there's a lot of pent up energy and demand. So you kind of have these conflicting forces where seasonals would suggest that we're probably due for a pullback, and, you know, it could give you a whole host of reasons of why the market should sell off. But then at the same time, you look at the bigger picture and we've gone sideways really for 2 years now. So, you know, if we were to break out above that, you could also view that pretty bullishly in a historical context.
Some would argue, and I don't know if you subscribe to this view, that really what the markets are undergoing is a sideways correction. As you pointed out, it's been almost 2 years that we've really gone nowhere.
Yeah, you could make the case it's been a correction through time. You could make the case that it's been a rolling bear market. And if you think back, obviously, you know, in late 2014, we started with the whole energy, materials, commodities theme. So, you know, almost all of those stocks already went through a bear market. You had the healthcare names. To some extent, you had some of the tech names. So really, I think what has happened is that you've had these mini sectors that have had their own bear markets, but they've just not all coincided at the same time, which is probably why we haven't seen a 20% decline on the overall index. You know, we got 14% or so, I think, at the February lows. The median stock was actually probably closer to 18% below its 52-week highs. But I think that's what's been, you know, frustrating to the bear case is that a lot of stocks and sectors have had their bear markets, but they just haven't hit the index level because it hasn't happened at the same time.
So how much of this also has to do, Jonathan, with how interest rates are really generations, if not century lows? I mean, where are you going to go if you want a rate of return? If you go to Europe, you got negative yields. If you go to Japan, you've got negative yields. And who would have thought that, you know, treasuries at 1.8 or 1.9 would look like junk bonds when you compare them to sovereigns elsewhere? So do you think part of this is just we're in this low interest rate environment where we have financial repression with central banks keeping interest rates low?
Yeah, that's certainly a very large factor. And I think that's what is in the back of people's minds is that if rates, you know, eventually start to move up or, you know, when the Fed does move again, that that's going to be the catalyst for the next sell-off. But you're seeing, you know, maybe in the last couple of weeks, some early signs that maybe people are anticipating that. You've actually seen the relative performance of the safe haven sectors, the high yields being utilities, consumer staples and telecom, you know, they've underperformed the market pretty drastically in the last 1 to 2 months. You know, rates have started to lift a little bit, not significantly, of course. So, you know, maybe people are anticipating a little bit of higher rates, but there's no question that, you know, the low rates in a general sense have been supportive here for risk assets.
Yeah, because one thing that you pointed out in this rally is you're seeing the lower quality type investments in stocks and even in credit break out versus high quality, and that tends to reflect a risk on trade. I know a lot of the worries at the beginning of the year was a Chinese slowdown, the possibility of the U.S. going into a recession, and that seems to be abated. And so do you think this accounts for what we're seeing now, or was it a fact that it was the low quality stuff that was pretty beat up?
There's two things. One, you know, if we were to look at the ratio of low quality to high quality, as you mentioned, that ratio had been moving lower for most of 2015, which was one of the reasons that had, you know, been getting us concerned as we moved into the middle of 2015. And so if we're using that reason to be cautious, the reversal obviously has to make us more constructive. So as you mentioned, low quality has been outperforming high quality since the February lows. It's still not back above where it was, let's say, in late last fall. We've still got a little more work to do, but clearly it's moving in the right direction. And again, as you mentioned, a lot of that is a function of these beaten down energy material names that, you know, basically they got so extended and so overdone on the downside in early part of this year that I think a lot of it to this point, what you're seeing is just a reversion or a snapback of that. The question going forward is, can they continue this upside momentum? And, you know, to us, it's getting a little bit too long in the tooth to say this is just a bear market rally in a lot of these names. In other words, one of the hallmarks of a new uptrend, regardless of what stock or asset class you're looking at, is it doesn't really give you a chance to get in. And a lot of these names, you've seen that, they fight off overbought conditions and they really don't give you a pullback to buy. So, you know, it's getting to the point where it seems a little bit more than just a reflex rally.
What about your opinion on the FANG stocks? I mean, you have Facebook now, looks like it's breaking out. They had good earnings. What about the FANG stocks?
So Facebook's obviously the clear leader there. You've seen Netflix and Google stumble a little bit, and then we'll see Amazon. We have earnings tonight. You know, I think maybe you're starting to see a little bit of breakdown in the correlation, right? So, you know, maybe they're not all just going to trade together like they did for much of last year. And on a relative basis, with the exception of Facebook, they're really underperforming the market. And that can be said for a lot of big cap tech. If you look at something like the NASDAQ 100, it actually made a 52-week relative low to the S&P yesterday for the first time in a few years. So we have this group of big cap, high growth tech stocks that have been outperforming the market for a couple of years. And now we're seeing that relative performance actually reverse a bit. And there's been a rotation into the whole energy material commodity space. So that's a big part of it. But, you know, we don't see any big breakdowns on an absolute basis for these names, these FANG stocks, but maybe they just continue to kind of underperform the market as they kind of grind higher.
Yeah, I want to talk about something, I guess, if you want to be contrarian on this market, and that's the VIX curve steepest since 2012. Let's talk about that.
Right. So what happens in times of fear, like we saw in August of last year and early part of this year, is the VIX curve actually flattens or goes into backwardation. And basically, there's a high demand for put protection, which makes this front month VIX or spot VIX actually spike up relative to the back month. And what we've seen recently is the complete opposite of that. So there's very little fear in the immediate term, and that's caused the curve to really steepen, and as you said, the highest level since 2012. So this is one of those metrics where there's two ways to look at it. If we're still in this range-bound market, then it could be a sell signal because, as a contrarian indicator, fear has kind of left the building, if you will. Now, the other way to think of it, and I don't think it's been determined yet, but if we are actually breaking out to a new trading range on the market, or if we're going to go into kind of this grind higher mode, then you would expect the curve to act like this and kind of stay like this. So, you know, you can look at it kind of both ways, but I do think it's notable that it's now the steepest that it's been in about 4 years.
Let's talk about gold for a minute, because we've had the dollar come down, and of course that's been helpful. That's helped emerging markets, but you also have gold that is breaking out, and then silver, which is also almost confirming gold's move. Silver's breaking out. What implications do you think that has, and what does that reflect?
Yeah, so gold, again, much like the whole commodity material energy space, the initial rally it had in the early part of this year has held very well. So that's the first thing. It's been in a trading range for the last couple of months, but to us, if it was a bear market rally, it probably would have rolled over again by now. And the second thing is that silver has actually now started to outperform gold. And that was one of the reasons that we weren't in love with the whole precious metal trade earlier in the year, is because we didn't see silver outperforming. And generally in really strong precious metal bull markets, you'll see silver outperform. It's the higher beta metal. And now you're really seeing that take place. So, and then additionally, you're seeing the other metals, platinum, palladium, really start to move to the upside. So the rally here, again, is probably more than just a reflex in the downtrend that started in 2011. I don't know how high it could go, but I think for now you have to stick with the bullish bias there on the metals. And to your point, you know, what is it saying? Well, part of it obviously is just a reflection of the weaker dollar. Whatever the argument is for precious metals, if it's a hedge against, you know, central bankers or global policy, whatever your reason is, the technicals do suggest that it's probably got some more runway on the upside here.
So given the state of the markets where we have now almost 11 consecutive weeks without trading below the prior week's low, you've got low quality outperforming high quality, and there's a tendency, we're getting into that seasonal pattern where the market tends to weaken, especially when you've had an extension here of consecutive movements in the market. What would you be doing here?
Well, I think you want to stay involved here because, like we said, if we are going to make new 52-week highs, that would be very bullish historically. And I think it's really a stock and sector call at this point. You know, coming into a seasonally weak period, up 11 weeks in a row, again, would not be surprising to see some consolidation or pullback here. But again, I think the big picture is that we've gone sideways for a couple of years. We've had these rolling bear markets, and there are areas that have kind of completed what we call a bearish to bullish kind of pattern. And again, to us, it looks more than just some reflex rallies in a lot of these names and sectors. So I think you can, you know, still selectively pick some of these energy commodity names and ETFs, and, you know, maybe tech, you want to kind of wait and let that kind of shake out, because these big cap tech names have been such outperformers for so many years that it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that they kind of underperform the market regardless of what it does here.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Yeah, the best way would be on Twitter. It's at jkrinskymkm, and also look for me on other media outlets.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program as my special guest is Dr. Karen Pollack. She's Assistant Vice Provost for Online Undergraduate and Blended Programs. She's also an Assistant Professor of Education at Penn State. Karen, let's talk about the history of Penn State World Campus. I just want to point out for our listeners that you were rated number one for a bachelor's program by U.S. News and World Report. So let's talk about the history of this world campus, how it began, when it began, and the success that you have had.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for inviting me to join the program. We did start at Penn State with a correspondence-based study program that had actually a more than 150-year history back when Penn State University was the Farmers High School. And so it was really evolved along with rural free delivery of mail. And we had our roots over 150 years ago in delivering correspondence study to farmers, sons and daughters who wanted to pursue their education and still be able to be at home and help with the family farm. So fast forward, 18 years ago, we evolved from a primarily correspondence independent study-based program to a fully online web-based collaborative campus, basically a full-service virtual campus that started with maybe five programs and 48 students in 1998. Today, we have 18,000 students and more than 100 programs available fully online.
Well, just when you think things are getting worse, all of a sudden you get a turnaround. And that's certainly the story for precious metals this year. After hitting an all-time low in February this year, gold and gold stocks and silver have been on fire. Joining us from U.S. Global is Frank Combs. And Frank, let's talk about gold. We've had this nice run-up that we've seen from the bottom in February, but we've seemed to be going sideways here. I know we're in that sort of season of the year you call the love trade. We might want to review that with our clients, but what are your thoughts on precious metals in terms of where we've come and where we might be going?
Well, first of all, the two critical drivers, the demand factors, the drivers for gold prices, I've characterized them as one being the love trade, which relates to Asia and the Middle East and their rising GDP per capita. And the other word to describe it is, I've called it the fear trade. And the fear trade is what dominates the thoughts in American investors, Canadian investors. And basically, the math suggests this, that any time a government generates a negative rate of return on their money, then what happens is gold rises in that country's currency. Now, what does that mean? It means the government's floating a five-year government bond at 1%, and inflation is running at 2%, so that's a minus 100 basis points negative return on your money. So that's a negative interest rate. And any time that happens, gold rallies. So we go back to September of 2011 when gold peaked at 1900, and you looked at the 10-year U.S. government bond, and you were to go buy that, you were locking in a 3% a year loss. So then we saw quietly, and this is where we all got fooled, is that there was no change in Fed funds rate, but real interest rates, that's the operative word, real interest rates, that is what the government will pay minus the CPI number, which comes out every 30 days, real interest rates went from minus 3% to plus 2%, and gold fell down to 1050. What we're seeing this year, unlike last year and the previous year, is that this year the U.S. is now going to negative rates, just like Europe, just like Japan. And this sort of competitive currency devaluation with negative real interest rates is making gold rise in all countries' currencies, in particular in the U.S.
So we have negative interest rates going for gold. Let's talk about the demand side. When gold hit 1900 and what was it, September of 2011, and of course it got all the way down to its low point in February of this year. What happened on the demand side? Typically, if we take basic economics, price drops, you should get greater demand. Just like when oil and gasoline prices came down, Americans were buying bigger cars and driving more. Does that same economic theory apply to gold? In other words, falling prices creates better demand.
Well, I think it's a great question. Most of the TV talking heads and Wall Street were knowing gold fell last year, and they kept just knocking it. But interesting enough, gold sales remained very, very strong, talking to gold dealers, in particular the Kitco, and they just saw an increase. So people, the more sophisticated retail investor, was buying gold on those down dips. What's happening this year, in particular when Japan went to minus 12 basis points to put money in their account, they're going to charge you, you saw $1 billion go into the GLD. And Pierre Lassonde was sharing with me that from the World Gold Council research, that every $1 billion that goes into the GLD, gold surges $30. And so we witnessed in the first quarter the net inflows going into the GLD and gold rising $150. What's interesting is that the gold equity ETFs had net redemptions. But in mid-April, they started getting net buying. So buying is starting to come into those equities. And we've really seen the first leg of gold stocks was short covering. And now we're seeing net buying.
So I know inflows play a major factor. You know, a mutual fund starts taking in a lot of money, you're going to have to go out and buy gold stocks. What about the roles of ETFs, and especially the bullion ones, Frank, like GLD, SLV? What role do they play in terms of the movement of the precious metal itself?
Well, clearly they move it, and there's a big audience of investors. Most of the quants used to just come in and use the futures market because it's less expensive. But it's the generalist. So when you get a generalist as a pension fund and he can't trade the futures market and they all of a sudden deem that the U.S. is going to go to negative interest rates, they're the ones that start putting money into gold, the GLD. And I think what's really important for your listeners is it's not the gold fund managers like ourselves which are going to dramatically move these markets. It's the generalists. And when the generalist becomes fearful and they see negative rates are on the horizon everywhere, and you have a $50 billion pension fund, or you have, and you say, I'm going to put in 1% into gold. Well, you're talking about a big number overnight, $500 million. And if they say, we're going to put in 10%, you're talking $5 billion. And what's happened is that earlier this year, Franco Nevada raised over $1 billion. Silver Wheaton just raised $500 million. Well, they were telling me that's predominantly come from generalists that believe we're going to live with negative interest rates now, and they're now coming into the marketplace. So they're the ones buying these deals.
You know, the other thing, too, you know, there was a short position in the metals. There were short positions in the stocks. And Frank, explain how small this universe is. I mean, when we take a look at if somebody wanted to invest in the tech sector, there's large cap stocks like Alphabet, Apple, other stocks, Microsoft, stocks like that. You go in the gold sector, I think if you added up the market cap of what, the XAU or the HUI or the GDX, it's paltry. It doesn't even come close sometimes to matching the market cap of a stock like Coca-Cola.
Well, the decline in Apple, for a classic example, just the decline, recent decline is greater than the dollar value of all the gold stocks combined.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is a small sector, but gold itself is the fourth most liquid asset class in the world, more liquid than real estate, and there's no big friction costs. When you travel abroad and you go to buy some other euros, etc., that spread can be 15% commission. It's outrageous. Gold doesn't have any type of a spread like that. So gold is very liquid and is a very tight spread.
So I know you speak at a lot of investment conferences. You're in the business. You're a portfolio manager. When you talk to your peers right now, what are they thinking? Are they that sort of consensus group that's saying, you know what, we're becoming a little fearful. We need to add a little gold here as a hedge?
Yeah, I think as mentioned, it's a generalist that is now believing that. And it's in full force. It's in motion. It's a bull market again. And the other data points is important to recognize is that the average bear market falls. If you go back the past 30 years, it falls about 4 years and falls about 45%. Well, if you look at the peak to trough in this one, it was 44% decline. It's not bad. So the average decline, and it took almost 4 years. It's a cookie cutter case study, and gold climbed out of its, if you take a look at December the 17th, that time frame, it's had a beautiful climb, and most people didn't believe it. So, you know, I think that we're in a positive gold cycle, and I think there's still lots of opportunities, but a lot of the mining companies are now making money. They deleveraged their balance sheet, they've cut overhead, and they know they cannot just grow for the sake of growth, that they have to have higher cash flow returns on invested capital if they want to create any value for themselves. So there's a new discipline like it's taken place in the airlines industry on the allocation of capital, and I think that a lot of these stocks trade higher.
Frank, how would you contrast, let's say, if this is the beginning of a new bull market, how would you contrast this bull market to, let's say, the conditions that existed in the previous gold market? I mean, if we go back to 2001, you had companies like Barrick and Newmont that were around. There was a consolidation in the industry after almost 20 years of a bear market in precious metals. There weren't as many producers around. There wasn't a lot of exploration that was going on. At the end, in this bear market, a lot of the juniors no longer exist. There isn't a lot of exploration around. A lot of people have been let go. A lot of mines have been shuttered. How would you contrast the conditions? Are they similar? You hear stories that companies are hedging again, kind of like what Barrick did at the beginning of the last bull market. Are they similar, or are there differences this time?
Well, there are big differences. I think that the big difference is the regulatory world in particular. You know, we just had this rule come through in the U.S., a fiduciary rule, and this fiduciary rule is in place now in the U.K., and it wasn't in Canada back in that beginning of that cycle. It was interesting, you know, in the past 2 years, that retail broker really has got to be so careful to tell a story in a gold stock, because if it goes down, he can become liable. If it goes up, that's okay. So the compliance departments at many of these brokerage firms, they've actually, there's been 50 of them shut down in Canada. It's just no business, and they can't go out and tell that story. And so the fundraising mechanism is definitely going to go through a big change. And I think it's positive in respect that you're going to see people getting ideas by listening to you, subscribers to your base. They're going to be more savvy while they use the internet like Kitco and look for information and insight. That's how I think it's going to shift. And I think there's more discipline in data management and quality analysis on picking companies, not just on a story, but something that has the reserves and management has a track record. And so I think that that's going to be positive. The other really important thought process is supply for gold miners has peaked. And I think that many of these mid-caps are going to be bought out. We saw Lakeshore, Claude Resources. These are companies we own. They had higher grade. They cleaned up their balance sheet. They had positive cash flow, and they get bought out. And I think we're going to see any mid-cap that's been able to de-risk the environmental issues, they've been able to navigate and stick handle through all the issues to get to production or try to expand production, that the seniors are going to turn around and buy them.
Yeah, because, I mean, with no major expiration, the cutback, and a lot of mines were taken offline because you couldn't operate them profitably. The problem when you're a resource company, when you're producing ounces of gold or it's oil, you got to replace them because stuff's going out the front door of the warehouse. You better have something coming in the back door. And the easiest way to go replace that is buy somebody else.
Correct. So that's where our biggest holding is, a company like Klondex. And Klondex is a much higher grade. When you take a look at the average gold mine, is a gram of gold per ton of rock. And we're dealing with a factor of 8 times that. And as they expand their production profile, I think that we'll see companies like Klondex get taken out. I think other companies like Endeavor, so Klondex is KDX, Endeavor is EDV. Endeavor is one of those other companies that has a huge profile, the Hyundai mine, they're in West Africa. If you look at just a quant model of these stocks, and one of them is look at cash flow, return on invested capital, if you just use that as your proxy to buy producers, and you only had 10 of them, you outperformed all the indexes by a wide margin. It's one of the most important metrics to look at, and KDX and EDV show up in the top 10 in high cash flow returns on capital.
In the last cycle, at the beginning, there were some great values in the market. But as the bull market took off, companies got careless with shareholder money. They over-diluted shareholders. They overpaid for companies that they bought. Do you think this is a more disciplined management that is in place in these companies now? Because, I mean, there was just terrible management decisions that were made by some of these CEOs of these companies that just over-diluted shareholders and really destroyed shareholder value.
Yes, and I think that the investors as a whole won't buy these deals. I think that the audience of money managers has changed, that they're much more quant-driven, and they're much more conscientious that management has a track record of allocating capital properly. There'll always be risks that you don't control Mother Nature's geology, or a government comes in and moves the goalposts with new taxes, etc. That's something management does not control. But how management does what they do control, that's much easier now to analyze their track record. And I think that money will go to those with proven track records. A classic would be the Dickinson Group in Vancouver that had the Pebble Project. That's another classic where the shareholders that came in to help out, they said, well, no, you can't. You got to cut your G&A. It has to be cut. You have to take a cut in your salary. And if you don't like it, well, we're sorry, then you're gone. And that's very different. That's very, very different. Never saw that before.
So right now, you said that production has probably peaked for a lot of these miners. How do they grow in a bull market? I mean, if we're in a bull market and you take a regular stock, let's say a technology stock, a manufacturing stock, you hope over time that sales increase. Along with increasing sales come increasing profits. What about a gold miner that is unable to increase its production? And maybe perhaps the only way they can increase production is by somebody else. So what kind of companies would you be going with?
And that's my thesis, because we've owned several of them this year that have been bought out. And so we're commenting on, Ralph and I were talking about it, in Klondike, which is in Nevada. KDX is a symbol in Toronto. It's got great management. They're extremely frugal. They have high grade. They have high cash flow returns on invested capital. Franco-Nevada has a royalty with them. Franco-Nevada respects and admires management greatly. And so I think that that's one of those companies that when we do our evaluation model of where they're going to be in the next 2 years, we think they're worth $9 and they're trade under $4. So we like those stocks.
So, Frank, as we take a look at, and one thing that you have always said is that 10% of your portfolio in gold, I've never heard you advocate that, you know, investors, you know, need to bet the farm on this. If you were starting out investing here, given where gold stocks have gone, given where bullion has gone, how would you play it? And would an investor, I mean, you have analysts, you have geologists, you understand mining, you have analysts that visit these projects, and so you can see what the operations are run like, you can take a look at samples. The average investor doesn't have that. Would they be better off in a fund like yours, or let's say an ETF, rather than trying to pick individual stocks?
I think it's better to pick an active manager like ourselves. We have a lot less volatility than the GDXJ. We far outperformed it last year when it fell. We fell, you know, half of what they fell. We're still up better than them, and we're 12 months. And I think that we know how to raise cash. We know how to separate stocks rather than just buying a basket of market cap weighted stocks. I think it's just better to buy an active stock. But what we get asked for, and I was trying to share with you, is that people ask, well, what do you like? What's in your portfolio? And our thesis is that we think these companies like the Klondike will get taken out, and so do we think Endeavor, EDV, it'll get taken out, and it'll be taken out by a major. So not only will these things get re-rated because of what they're doing organically, someone else is going to come along and snap them up.
Well, listen, Frank, before we close, given where places have gone, where we've seen bullion has gone from below 1,100, now it's over 1,200, silver is almost close to $18, what would you be doing here?
Well, it's still my 10% rule. And if you're going to be in this space, you should have 5% in gold coins or bullion or beautiful gold jewelry, and 5% into gold stocks, and consider an active manager like ourselves at US Global. Go to usfunds.com, and you can get all the proper disclosure and information and insight. We publish. There's no other gold fund manager that publishes every Friday on the world of gold. And it's done like your professional football or basketball team. It's called the SWOT analysis. We look at the strengths and weaknesses last week that impacted gold and what could be an opportunity threat next week based on, is it Fed Fund Minutes next week or is it PMIs out next week? This can impact the price of gold. We help manage that thought process, and we keep it only three sentences each, so it's not run away. It's comprehensive yet concise. And I think that that's something that for investors to consider is visit usfunds.com and get an idea of how we look at the world of gold.
Well, listen, Frank, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Well, same with you. And I think it's great that you maintain your enthusiasm towards the asset class through both up and down cycles and understand that these trends can last. And as I said, I'll be writing a special on the other factors driving gold, and I remain very bullish on it.
Coming up in the next hour, we have a special big picture for you. We'll hear from both Dave Morgan and from Don Cox. Dave Morgan speaking on the difference between paper assets such as paper gold and paper silver and the real metals themselves, why the price disparities, and an interview with Don Cox. Gold's performance may be linked to rising cynicism and fear. Speaking of fear, never fear. We will be back as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.